Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to get into the business of podcasting. And I thought to myself, well, who do I know who knows anything about podcasting? And I racked my brains a bit, but then it occurred to me, Carl Benjamin knows a bit about podcasting. Thank you for joining me.
I don't think I do, actually. not an expert.
Well, I think you've done all right. You've had a...
Done all right. <laughs> done
a reasonable career on the whole podcasting thing. So
yeah.
Let's start with this one. What is the secret to keeping an audience engaged from the moment they click on a video to actually getting them to watch the whole thing? How does that work?
I mean, I really don't know. Like, there's a whole industry and theory behind it that I'm aware that it exists. I've just never spent any time looking at it. The thing is, like, I have always approached this very impulsively. So I never had a plan behind anything. And I just did things that I thought were a good idea to do. And so it just seemed like I just had things I wanted to say. And so I would just lay out my thoughts and like, look, this is what I have to say about the subject. And I guess I happen to be the right kind of person to be able to grow an audience. I don't really know, you know.
To be fair, you do impart wisdom to the troops as you go along. I mean, one thing that you said that always resonated with me is never waste the audience time.
Yeah, that's the only real maxim I have.
Yeah.
When it comes to it, it's like...
Because, I mean, this is something I notice with a lot of content producers. There are people out there, big brains, useful stuff to say, but I'll often watch them and they start their stream and it will be 20 minutes of getting their coffee mug facing the right way, and it would be like saying hello to people in the chat, which is great for audience engagement and stuff, but you know, they're just warming up and they tell you several times, okay, I think we can get going now, and then they shuffle around a bit more
because they're waiting for the audience to trickle in as
the
notifications go out and whatnot.
But I suppose it's part of how you came up on this is that you kind of came up in the more the video essay format, and things have kind of changed, and your video has always been like straight into it, so there's no gap at the front.
Yeah, I don't want to waste people's time.
Like, yeah,
people are busy. Yeah.
So what was it? I mean, because it's kind of changed, isn't it? Because when you started, it was much more the video essay sort of format, and it kind of feels like everyone's, to your point, they're kind of moving away from that into the more the sort of live stream type model.
Yeah, I assume that there's two things behind this. The first one being on the creator side, it's just easier to make live stream content. It's way easier. And on the audience side, you know, like there's just so much less editing that goes into it. Because like for anyone who's on the receiving end of the YouTube video rather than the production end, if you're making like a long form YouTube video, there's a huge amount of editing that goes in. Like probably two or three times as much time goes into editing the video than it does writing and recording it. So that is a definite advantage, and you combine that with the incentive to try and get super chats and things like that, then you've got a financial incentive to do live stream content. And on the audience side, you get to hang out with the person that you like. A lot of it is what is known as parasocial relationship, where people, and this happens with me as well, you know, with content creators I watch on YouTube and whatnot, you feel that you've grown to know the person because you spent so much time listening to their thoughts. And so, you know, talking to them and getting their input on a particular thing that you've wanted to say for them or whatever. There's a big incentive there, I think, as well.
Yeah. And then sometimes you meet them and they have no idea who you are. And
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of jarring. But yeah, so I mean, because something happened there, didn't it? Because in the early days, it was all about the video essay and these sort of tightly edited things. And I remember before I sort of joined Lotus Eaters, I thought I'd turn my hand to doing some of these video essays. And I was just completely bowled over by the amount of work that goes into it. Because I thought the work was having something interesting to say and then saying it and then do a little bit of editing and then you upload it. But actually you could spend an afternoon making a video and then the next two or three days editing it and getting that right, especially if you're not used to that editing process.
Yeah, and especially if you want to do anything fancy with it as well. Like, I don't do anything fancy on my videos back in the day because I just didn't have any skills in it.
Yes.
So I just very basic put things on a timeline and then that was it.
Okay. Why was it that you made the transition from YouTube to Lotus Eaters? Because, I mean, you had well over a million subscribers.
No, I had like 970,000.
Oh, okay.
But nearly a million.
Right.
But, because YouTube is a political platform now. Never used to be. YouTube used to be a very politically neutral platform, and everyone had their channel and their own little domain, and YouTube had a very hands-off approach. And then advertiser boycotts began with PewDiePie, because he made a joke, or a few jokes, in his videos.
Right.
And the Wall Street Journal created a scandal with this, and I learned later that the majority of YouTube advertising is done through six companies, and these companies control the advertising for, like, you know, mega corporations like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, McDonald's, and all that. And the middleman corporation, one of these six, one of them pulled out entirely, and that's probably billions of dollars. And that caused YouTube to react. And so suddenly, I think it was like in 2017, 2018, suddenly a lot of things, there was a sort of domino effect where many things changed. So, like, old videos, YouTube just went through loads of people's channels, just pulled a bunch of their videos without giving them strikes. Because, and this kind of implied that YouTube knew, look, you know, this wasn't the way it was, and we're not going to punish you, but it's the way it is now, and we will punish you going forward. And so in 2019, when they demonetized my channel, I realized, okay, well, YouTube isn't a safe platform. If you want to be able to push the boundary against the left-wing thought in any way, you need to have some sort of insurance provision, because some shitheel leftist with blue hair at YouTube will just turn you off like that. And lots of people I know who I don't think deserved it. For example, Stefan Molyneux is a great, good example of this. Someone who is very moderate, very reasonable chap, just got his, again, 900 plus thousand YouTube subscribers just taken off because of something taken out of context.
Yeah, that was all genuine shame, wasn't it? Because he used to produce really good content. It was well-researched. He used to do these sort of presentation things. And he's still, I think, on Rumble or something. But
But he didn't do anything wrong, is the point. And someone at YouTube just decided, no, we can't have him because he was falsely smeared as a white nationalist and therefore gone. And it became apparent that if you want to be able to exist in perpetuity doing content creation, you're going to have some backup. The same sort of thing happened when I was kicked off Patreon. I was like, I didn't do anything wrong according to their own terms of service. But they had moral umbrage at me, and therefore they took me off. And so there are other alternatives, but you definitely need to have a plan in place if you are in the right-wing sphere.
So when did you start?
2013, I uploaded my first video.
And what was that sort of initial four-year period like?
I mean, at first, I just figured we were invisible because we were nobodies, right? So people probably don't remember, but in 2013... it was verboten to criticize feminism. And so we were doing, you just couldn't do it. And it was something that the mainstream didn't have any conception of. And so when I started putting out videos saying, look, I think this feminism stuff's a bit rubbish. I didn't know anything about content creation. I'd never done it before. And I didn't have any conception of the scope of the thing or what it would become. And so for the first few years, we were just flying completely under the radar because nobody cared. Nobody knew we were, didn't pay any attention to us. But then we started making a cultural impact on things, and, you know, millions and millions of people were watching videos, and suddenly it was like kind of blowing out of proportion. But even then, even like 2015, 2016, 2017, it was still just the Wild West YouTube. Everything was going. And then I think it was 2018 where the people who were at the top of the pyramid started realizing that something was happening down at the bottom of the pyramid, that they needed to step in and put some severe restrictions on. And so that's what they did.
And what was it like dealing with YouTube in those early days? Because I remember there was a shift in language. They used to talk about you as partners, and it felt like there was a whole different approach and something. Well, you described what happened, but it seems like there's a very clear pre-ad cancellation period and afterwards.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the catchphrase YouTube used to use was broadcast yourself.
Right.
They don't use that anymore. Same as Google had don't be evil. They don't have that
anymore. And they dropped both of those, haven't they?
They did, yeah. Google owns YouTube, by the way.
Did Google own YouTube when you started?
I don't know.
It was one of their early acquisitions. I think they might have done.
Yeah, they may have done. I don't know, though. I mean, you'd never have any contact with YouTube itself because it was just a very remote foreign corporation.
Oh, I just kind of assumed at some point, especially at your scale, you had an appointed representative or something, a partner or...
I'm sure you can get those things, but I have never had one.
Okay.
So I don't know. I know that, you know, some people do, but the thing is, I don't know how, like, useful they actually are. Like, this seems to be a way of fobbing off the YouTube community, as far as I can tell. Because no one who actually needs them seems to get them. And those people who get them, well, don't seem to need them. So,
what were you doing before that? Were you just some sort of gentleman scholar reading philosophy and smoking cigars?
No. I was just working in various jobs in Swindon. just tech jobs, mostly. Just because I could do them.
But what made you think, oh, that thing where I can watch cat videos and bum fights, I'm going to sit down and start doing political stuff?
I didn't really think of it as being overtly political at the time. I was, because again, none of the community that grew up around it existed at the time. So I just was frustrated with the fact that in my job, my female bosses were being told that they needed to go on women in leadership courses. And I'm like, I don't have a single male boss. You know, they're like, oh, we need to get more women in leadership. And so this doesn't make any sense. Why are you doing this anyway? And then it started coming to video games, which I happened to be interested in. And so I just started putting my thoughts out just as like on into the ether. And it began from that.
And how quickly did it go from something where, I mean, presumably you did this after work or something, or at the weekends.
Yeah. And I found myself, I lost my job because I think my boss was a bit jealous of me. I think he was worried that I was going to take, like, I had a supervisor, but then we had a female boss. And my supervisor, I think, kind of may have been like, look, you need to get rid of him for some reason. But I found myself unemployed for a couple of months. And so I was just like, well, I'll just do, you know, put these videos up. And then I started gaining traction. And I started making money. I was like, okay, well, then I won't bother finding another job.
Oh, it was quite quick then, was it?
Yeah. Within a few months, I was able to, you know, look at it and go, okay, I'm making some money here. That's, you know, making a couple of grand. I was like, okay, that's a job, you know?
Yeah. And then you sort of stepped up and it really kind of started to climb, did it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think about any of these things at the time because this is all totally new ground for me, and I didn't really watch much on YouTube either, so I didn't really know what like other content creators did, and I just made really terrible videos. But I was just talking about a subject that very few people were prepared to talk about in a way that was fairly unique, and I guess I was able to pitch at a higher level than most people. You know, a lot of people go in a sort of baseline takes. I was able to do a bit better than that, I think.
So how much did you, I mean, especially in those early days, how much did you sort of think it through? And because your videos, I remember them at the time, they seemed very well reasoned and considered. I don't know if you actually did that or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, I spent the time on the argument, not the production. I would go and just read their stuff or watch their conferences and things like that and just spend time going, okay, and the trying to figure out what their worldview is. And the thing is, looking back now, it's charming how naive, not just myself either, but any other content creator in this sort of sphere, because we would approach it from a very basic liberal position of, why are we having sex discrimination here? What's the purpose of this? You know, I thought that we had all agreed that we weren't going to discriminate on arbitrary characteristics and we were going to judge each other by the content of our character and our merit. So what would be the point of any of this? And, you know, don't you realise what you're doing? Of course, they knew exactly what they were doing. And we were just well outside of the loop on all of this. Yeah. And it took us many years to sort of go deep enough into their own ideology to realize how bonkers it is.
Yeah, it becomes apparent now that for a long time, the right has been playing checkers and the left has been playing chess, and we just didn't see it.
Well, the thing is, I wouldn't even call this time in YouTube the right. Right? These people weren't right wing. They were like, we were all left, not left wing, but we were all liberal, and we held all of the liberal assumptions, and we weren't trying to overthrow liberalism or anything like that. It was just, we thought that what was being done was illiberal and immoral.
And okay. And how would you describe, in the early days, your politics? Because you seem to me to be a bit lefty, and you seem to have shifted a bit.
I was never like left, as in, you know,
yeah,
a communist or something.
Well, when I say left, I mean the kind of left that doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, we were kind of just soft liberals, you know, so it was like,
right.
Well, you know, constitutional rights are a good thing. Limited government's a good thing. Social welfare probably does help the most disadvantaged. That's probably a good thing. So it's very, you know, very soft social liberals with no particular hard edge to anything that we wanted. Essentially, we were like, can't these people just leave us alone and get on with our lives as we always have? And of course, turns out, no, that's not the case. Mm. But no one that I knew was very hard line on anything.
Mm. You may have become since.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So in that post-2017 period, how have you been treated differently to a left-wing content creator?
Well, there's definitely a lack of privileges, lack of access, lack of concern and consideration, and a general targeting because they just see you as an other. And so they treat you as another. And so you become aware that you're in enemy territory.
Were you trying to be another?
No. If you look at the early videos I made, I'm speaking very much within the sort of liberal space and saying, why are we doing this? You know, as I didn't consider myself to be an outsider. And it was only after I essentially got tack-feared out of the left, I was like, okay, fair enough, I must be.
Is it like that meme of the centre line,
yeah,
and somebody
of, yeah,
there, and then the left runs off?
Yeah, at least initially, definitely. Yeah.
And since this had sort of transitioned into being a career for you, and obviously very much so with the formation of the Lotus Eaters, how do you keep the balance between kind of open, accessible content, but the need to monetize as well? Because, of course, a big problem with anyone who isn't left-wing on YouTube is you're going to lose your monetization. It's only a matter of time if you get it at all in the first place.
And there are lots of people who know this has happened to. And a lot of people I don't even think are very controversial. But anyway. I mean, the most important thing is just having a source of income that YouTube isn't in control of. That's just it.
Right.
Because they will target you eventually, and they will say, well, if we don't, the advertisers, and that may well be true, you know, I mean, whatever, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, whoever owns these, the company that aggregates the advertisers with their various ESG requirements, they may well be holding YouTube over a barrel. Because, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think it was YouTube that really cared about any of this stuff. It was only when it was external and intrusive, because if you look at it from YouTube's point of view, well, they're like, well, look, we just want monetization on everything. What, I mean, YouTube has always lost money, right? The platform's just too big to be profitable, and so Google and Alphabet prop it up. And so there's no incentive for YouTube to be like, yeah, we're going to demonetize that, we're going to demonetize that, we're going to demonetize that. They would, I mean, and they used to have literally everything monetized. I mean, one of the primary concerns was that advertisements were appearing alongside Holocaust denial content, right? That was, like, that was one of the primary things in, I think it was 2017 or 2018. And you think, okay, that does speak to a more insane time, again, a more Wild West time in YouTube's history. You can't imagine there being Holocaust denial content on YouTube at all now, let alone it being monetized, you know, for them to complain about. So, yeah, things definitely have changed. And if you are thinking about being a right-wing content creator, make sure you have some sort of backup. That's just it.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting they went down the route that they did, because, of course, I mean, they could have easily put together a system where if you're an advertising agency, you could just specify a whole bunch of channels that you
didn't... They have that. They had that already.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Okay.
It didn't matter. Because the point was that that means that... I mean, they could have... We said this at the time. You could, whenever an advertiser says, well, I'm not happy that my advertisement is being placed alongside that content, you've got a couple of things. One, nobody thinks that the advertiser is specifically saying, right, I want Nikes to be sold alongside the Holocaust denial content or else. No one thinks that. Everyone just thinks, well, it's a essentially random serving of an algorithm that pops up the thing that you're viewing. So nobody thought that anyway. But let's assume that everyone did think that. The advertiser controls are very comprehensive and were at the time. And so they were in charge of what could come up. And so when, like, the Wall Street Journal or whoever found, like, one video, obviously, that has, you know, one offensive video that has the advertisement in front of it, it's obviously because whoever paid for the advert just took a really broad net and was just like, yeah, just on anything, I don't care, or whatever, right? Yeah. So they had those controls anyway. It doesn't matter. You know, what it was about gaining narrative control of YouTube. That was the purpose of it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.